very young. I don't, the dog probably wasn't there then. I don't remember that.
Yeah, I just, I specifically, the most amount of time I spent with Allison was, like, her and her dogs, and, like...
But that would be, I was going to say, that would be Allison.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I had the strangest experience with her. She had these two, I want to say Alaskan Malamutes, but I know that's wrong. It was a kind of a smaller dog, but definitely a winter dog.
Mm-hmm.
There was two of them, and they both had a respective ball that they were allowed to play with. And one of the dogs came up with the other dog's ball, and Allison just very calmly looked at the dog random, and was like, "That's not your ball. You need to. If I'm gonna play with you, you need to get your ball." And the dog just stared at her for like 5 seconds, then put down the ball and went and got. And I was just like floored. I was like,
"Yeah,
you just had a complex conversation with the dog, and
yeah,
the dog understood you.
That's what she was about."
And she's just like, I talked to them just like I would talk to you. And it was just, like, such a mind-blowing experience.
David loved her very much.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's what got him.
Because he was supposed to recover from it.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
I talked to him briefly after Allison passed. And
you talked to him?
I emailed him. I sent him.
And he returned an email?
Yeah. About 2 weeks before his death.
That's... You saved that, because that's...
Oh, I did. Absolutely.
That's unusual. Not very many people got emails at that time.
And he said, you know, it was a troubling time, but that he was surrounded by family and friends. So that's all you can really ask.
Well, they played at his memorial, they played a recording of him talking and Allison talking about their life and how they met, who they were. And Allison was, at that point, it was terminal. She was going to have it. But she sounded stronger than David. You could hear in David's voice the weakness. It was telling. And in that picture, it's on his website, he looked so frail, and she still looks vital. Pretty amazing. I think that it was just too much for him to lose her. She was pretty much everything to him. She was his balance.
Right.
Amazing woman. Amazing people. Yeah.
So I guess let's get into it. So did you have a chance to look over the questions?
I did.
And do you want to just start going down?
You. I'd like to be out there with those guys at 25 after.
Okay.
We have about an hour.
Cool. Great.
Does that work for you?
Yeah. I hadn't finished the transcriptions of the interview processes, and I had like just a collection of WAVE files from my experience that after the experience, it was a very powerful one. And And I kind of wanted to step away from it for a little bit.
That's what I said. You get in so deep that you just can't take it anymore.
Yeah. Just discovering things about yourself that you never thought you would touch.
That's what his music's about for the performer. We had many, many deep conversations about the repertoire he wrote and about the way he went about writing and what he was trying to do. But his idea of what he was facing with humanity and people who had to find themselves, he wrote that in his music. It's as much about the person, the individual player in the ensemble that's playing it, as it is about the piece itself. That's pretty rare.
Right. Yeah, and so originally, this was kind of, especially after his death, I definitely didn't want to touch it. But I heard that you were coming, and I probably wouldn't get another opportunity like this reasonably anytime soon.
This has been I won't go in too deep about it because it's... I mean, it's very fragile with me right now. And I'm... But I feel a tremendous responsibility to him right now. There's not a rehearsal I go in that I don't feel him right there talking to me. And I don't want to hurt him. This to be what it is.
Absolutely.
Desperately. And that's kind of frightening, actually.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I'm human. I'm not David Mesnick. I'm just a guy.
I understand that. It's kind of why I haven't been working on any of his pieces lately.
Yeah.
It's just, it's...
Yeah, too soon.
Yeah.
This was not supposed to be this way. I suggested two totally different programs to Dr. Senatol about a year ago, and they had, David was not part of it, but neither of the programs I suggested were programs that he felt comfortable with. And so I love Symphony Number 8, and I know the difficulty of it, I know the length of it, and so, but I also knew that if there's a place in the world that could do a piece like this, it'd be here. So I suggested that, and he said yes right away. So I believe that there was some, David was fine a year ago.
Yeah.
So the fact that this is happening now is, I don't know. I don't know why it's happening, but it is.
Yeah, I had a very peculiar conversation with him.
With David?
Yeah. About halfway through the week, we were getting ice cream in downtown Missoula. And this very cute little, like, hipster-esque ice cream shop, but we were somehow gone in the conversation of reflecting upon different stages of life, and he very much so believed that he was in the final stage of, like, he was talking about finding ways of coming to terms and acceptance with the climax of his life. And I thought that was very dark, especially because he was in such good shape and he didn't have any reason to think about that.
I saw him. I did the last band premiere with him in Virginia, the Virginia Allstate Band, piece called The Seeker. And we had lunch, we had dinner together, we had lunch together, we hung out, talked as usual. I was always tried to find out what he was thinking. Sometimes it's difficult to accept. But he looked fine. I mean, it was like, okay, I'll see you. It's not very long, I hope. And then this happened. Shocking.
When was that? The Seeker.
Well, The Seeker would. You can find it online, but it would have been. And if you want a recording of it, I can get you a recording. There's one online. It's not very good, but I can get you a good recording of it. If you're interested in it, it's not a very long. It's about maybe 12, 13 minutes. But it was in Virginia, and it would have been April or May.
Of this year.
Of this year. Yeah. So it was just months. And everything was fine. I mean, it looked fine. He was tired. He'd been traveling, and he was tired. But I have pictures of him. At that place. I think I can get it pretty quick. Hopefully, you know, you never know about these things. My phone seems to, I've upgraded the new software and it just seems to be slower than it's ever been. We talked about all kinds of things, and he worked with the kids, and he was great, and everybody had a terrific time.
Right.
Then he left. I don't know what happened. I can't find it. Personally.
Did you happen to talk to him around that time?
Oh yeah.
Like close to when Allison passed.
Well, he sent me a note saying that he was ill and that she was dying, and I responded to him, and we talked via email. I did not talk to him in person, and I regret that very much. I longed to hear his voice. on the phone one more time. But I hear his voice every day. And every day this past week and a half has been, I hear it all the time. All the time. And it's challenging. Difficult. Difficult stuff to do. But I'm hopeful that that he's, I know he's at peace. I know he is. He's with Allison. He's, I believe that. But I feel alone for a little while. It's a loss, big loss. I mean, he gave me things that I had not had before. I mean, I've always loved music and I've always loved doing things, but he taught me things I didn't even know were out there. I didn't know were there. And he gave me freedom to feel about those things instead of just know. And he was such a dynamic force in my life that it's difficult to not have him. Took it for granted, like the same anything else would do.
Right.
My mom, or anything like that, you know? But he's, I learned, I mean, there was a time, honestly, that I wouldn't do any of his music. Years, a couple, three, maybe 4 years, I didn't do any of his music because I couldn't think about anything else. And there were people out there, voices that needed to be heard, and I needed to experience them before it was too late. And so I sought out, I've always been a composer guy, or at least in my college teaching days. And I wanted to know about other people. I wanted to know what other people were saying and what they had to say. And I learned so much from them also. And I've been really lucky. But David was such a strong voice in my mind that dominated my thinking. And I don't think that's an unusual thing. Must sound unusual to you, but I don't think it is. Bruno Walter, do you know who Bruno Walter was? He was a great conductor. As a matter of fact, it was he, Mahler died before he heard either, I don't think he heard 8, but he for sure did not hear 9. Bruno Walter did the world premiere of 9. So Bruno Walter and Mahler were close, very close. But Bruno Walter stayed away from Mahler in the earlier years for quite a while because he couldn't take it.
Right.
But then he went back to 9. Well, he was back with Mahler before that. But Bruno Walter sought help, psychological help, because it's like a coin. He said on one side of the coin, he could not bear the responsibility of interpreting this music and bringing it to life. But on the other side of the coin, he could not bear not to. Same way playing an instrument or interpreting something, doing something that's artful, human. It's a big, big responsibility. And for not, unless the music's worth that, but there is music worth that. So, yeah.
I guess that kind of nicely transitions into the first question.
Okay.
Could you maybe give just a little bit of background information leading to your first contact with Child's Gardens of Dream Garden? I just can't pronounce it.
Yeah,
that.
Child's.
You know
Garden.
What I mean?
I do. I was a public school teacher for 20 years, which is a long time. And it was in my last maybe 2-3 years of teaching public school. There was a college band director that lived not far from my house, and he had gone to school at Northwestern, saxophone player. His name was Bill Hockeppel. And Bill was an interesting guy and a fabulous player. And so he says, I've got this recording that John Painter sent me, who John was the director of wind ensemble at Northwestern. And he said, I'd be interested in what you think about it. And it was late at night, and I remember we were in his apartment, and it was quiet, and that music started, and I had never heard anything like it. And I could not for the life of me understand what was happening to me. But it challenged me to the very root of everything that I didn't know what it was, but I wanted to know. And I knew that I wasn't going to do that with high school kids. I loved being a high school band. I loved the kids I was working with, but I wanted to know what that was, and I wasn't going to do those things with kids because I'd hurt them physically and mentally and emotionally, because it was challenging me, and it was going to challenge me, and it was going to challenge them. So I heard that, and so I wanted to know how that happened. And I didn't know David Maslanka from anybody. So I decided that I wanted to do his music, or at least experience it, or something like that. But it was specifically him. So I decided that I would audition, apply for college jobs. And you got to remember now, this was 35, almost 40 years ago. Long time. And so I applied and was offered two jobs, one about 30 miles from my house and one 3,000 miles away from my house at the University of Connecticut. And it was pretty simple. I mean, you just move 30 miles, you don't even have to sell your house. Or move 3,000 miles where you don't know anybody or anything. Well, there it was. It was the blackness, and I took it because I didn't know what was there, so I had to go find out. Well, so I went there, and it was a terrific experience. And about I wanted to do Child's Garden of Dreams, but my band could not even come close. I mean, it would have been a bad experience for everybody. So about 7 years into my tenure at the University of Connecticut, I had just the world's best chairman. Her name was Dorothy Payne. She inspired me to do things that I never knew I could even begin to do. She was a visionary woman and a leader of people like nobody I had ever met. And so I was in her office talking with her about some budgetary consideration, I assume. I don't remember exactly, but it was not artful. So she just kind of as I was leaving the door, she says, when's your next concert? And I said, in 2 weeks. And she said, what are you playing? And I told her what we were playing. And I said, and we're doing a piece, a relatively new piece, by a composer, Charles Garden of Dreams, by a composer, David Maslanka. She said, she looked at me, she said, would you like to have him come? He was living in New York at the time. And I said, you got to be kidding. How can you do that? She said, well, he and my husband were roommates at Michigan State University. And I just couldn't believe that this could be possible. I had gone into blackness, and here was David Maslanka. You figure that out. And so I walked out of her office, and my feet weren't even touching the ground until about halfway down the hall. Then I realized he was coming, and all of a sudden it was a different story. But he came, and that was the beginning of our relationship. And it was earth-shattering, changed me in every way humanly possible from an artful point of view. I don't think that from a moral point of view or standards, I've changed much. My thinking about them and the way I think about what I do has changed drastically since that time. But it was a friendship born out of fire. It was that hot. And I learned a lot the hard way. So that was my first initial contact with him.
Maybe do you have any observations about how that relationship with, because you commissioned a couple works by him.
Actually, I've premiered four with his. And then I've been part of consortium on most of them.
Gotcha. So over the years, maybe do you have any reflections on how that relationship evolved, both between you and the music?
I think more than the music, it was him. That first meeting, he came to school. It was a Friday rehearsal. We had Friday rehearsal and a Monday rehearsal, and the concert was the following Wednesday. And we had to split it up into two because I couldn't get through everything. So we did the first two movements of Child's Garden, and he was very happy. He was pleased. And then we started the third movement, which is the movement, I can't remember the exact title of it, but it's the movement where the creature destroys this little girl. And the tempo is marked 160, 180, fast. It's in three, little, fast. And the woodwind parts are just blistering. And so I started that movement, and I got about three bars and he stopped me. And he came up to the podium where I was standing and the ensemble was sitting there, and he says, "Your tempo is too slow." He says, "About 120. And did a little. And I said, "That it's 120 exactly." He says, "That's not my tempo. My tempo was 180. And I said, "My ensemble's hearing this conversation. This is not a private thing. This is with my instrument, which is the ensemble, which is sitting right in front of me." And he said, "Okay, so I want it faster, and if we miss notes, we'll sweep them up after the concert." And I said, "You better bring a bushel basket, because we're going to miss a lot of them trying to lighten it up." And he said, "Has to go." And then he said this to me, and I'll never forget it. He said, "Don't impose your restrictions on my music." And that hurt. That hurt. Still hurts. It was like a lightning bolt through the heart. Because I was trying to make it right for him by playing it clean. And he didn't care about that. He wanted the life. And so we tried, did the best we could, went on, finished the rehearsal, and then he came back on Monday, finished rehearsals, and we got to the concert on Wednesday night. And I took the tempo 120, because that's what I had taught them. I thought I was doing the right thing, but I was wrong. And but I could not ask them to do something that I had instructed them to do over a long period of time. I would have been wrong then. So I took it slow, where we could play it. And I saw him after the concert, of course, and I looked at him, and his eyes were red. And there were tears, and I hurt him. I hurt him bad, because that wasn't his music. And so now, when I play his music, or Stravinsky or Bach or Colegrass or Chris Rouse, I'll do everything in my power not to hurt them. Whatever I have to do. And I realize that that's a big responsibility, but he taught me that poetry is more than a note. And I struggled. I work hard. Remember the other day in rehearsal when I said the thing I miss about teaching is watching people struggle? And everybody laughed. I wasn't kidding. And I love that, because that's what you have to do. I mean, how easy is it to be a musician and to try to do what you have to do in order to create or recreate an artful situation? It's human. So he taught me that. And it's the most startling thing I've ever had come up against. there have been plenty since then, and we've had a lot of conversations since then, but that was the first time that I was confronted with something greater than who I am. It always was there, but I wasn't smart enough to realize it. Now, I'm very sensitive to it.
Sort of going to a different topic. So this is a question that I was, it kind of seemed like a left field thing, and I don't, maybe I missed something, but could you explain how the baton you gave to him?
How do you know about that?
I read it on, in some dissertation.
Maybe at Brenton's. I don't remember that Brenton had it in there.
But it was very striking when I first read it.
So, of course, basically what happened was, not long after that experience, David came back to Connecticut, where he did a residency at the Hart School of Music. And they did the Dvorak Serenade, Wind Serenade, and they did Child's Garden of Dreams. So I went, and I sat in the back, hoping to avoid David, because I just couldn't take it. I just wanted to be there to hear his music.
Had you tried to repair the relationship?
Oh, our relationship was never injured.
Oh.
Never. Never.
So even though he was hurt at the time, it was...
Oh, yeah. He still... he knew, and I knew, that I would never hurt him again. I'd do everything in my power.
Gotcha.
But I always tried. I mean, if you really love somebody, you'll do whatever you can to help them. Your relationships are going to be tested with things that are not seemingly a relationship of care and compassion and love, but they are very strongly molded in that vein. So no, our relationship was never strained. I suspect some of our conversations were, but never to the point of breaking. I mean, it was just like, what are you doing and why are you doing that? I mean, I need to know. So, so I went, and he saw me, and so we sat together. And my heart's just pounding. I mean, I'm next to this man that just is not even human. And so this concert's over, and everybody's talking, and David's up talking to people. And so when it's over, we went to get a cup of coffee or something. And during that time, I don't know why I even did this. I mean, we didn't have any money. We were barely able to put the thing together. So I said, just out of my mouth came, would you be interested in writing a piece for us? He said, absolutely. Now I'm in real trouble, because I don't know how I'm going to get the money. And I just thought he wouldn't even consider it, but he was very interested. And so he comes back, and we do Symphony Number 2. And I used this baton. He wanted something of mine.
And you originally sent like a figurine?
I had a conductor that I cherished. My father-in-law made it for me. And so I offered it, and he says, no, I need something you touch every day. So I gave him my baton. And he took it and meditated with it, he said. And I did not talk to him about anything. I gave him the baton, but I did not talk to him. I told him I wanted a piece of moderate difficulty, about 20 minutes long, so we had a chance to play it. And of course, I get an hour-long symphony that's just impossible,
right,
which I think I told you guys. But the thing that the reason why the baton is so significant is because I grew up in Oklahoma, a fairly poor family. I mean, there was plenty of everything that we needed, but we didn't have any excess. And so, in Oklahoma, there were class divisions, you know, middle class, upper class. Then it was segregation. It was white and black, and I remember very clearly when I was a young kid that there was a place where white water fountains, black water fountains, or bathrooms or whatever. It's always been weird to me, but that's what was there when I was a kid. And in addition, there was Indian. There was a big Indian population there. Creek, Cherokee, Choctaw, all kinds of Indian people. Well, I'm Indian. I have Cherokee in me, a lot of Cherokee. And so I tried to hide that because, you know, when you're young, you want to be popular. And so I wanted to be accepted. I didn't tell anybody that. Nobody. So David sends me the second movement of the symphony first, and I get it, and along with it is a note saying, this is what we need, this is what you need above all else. The rest of the symphony will follow, and it will be about you, but this is the one that you need most. And it was an Indian song, on the baritone saxophone. You'll hear it. If you listen to the symphony, you'll hear it. Man, I was so disappointed. Well, where in the world did you come up with this thing? He said, well, it's you. I never told him a thing.
It seems like almost magical.
He was making me look who I am. He's forcing me. You want to move forward? Who are you? And what will you accept as your responsibility? And it's more. There's a lot more. I'll send you. I can share with you the exact documentation of what he's talking about. I've got it. Letters that thick. Not very many people know that. Not that detail. I'm fine with it, but it's kind of spooky.
Right. And so, did you? I guess we can, I can peruse through the documentation and we can talk about it some more another time, but that's my otherworldly stuff.
Well, you take a look at this symphony we're playing. You get to the, you go through all that, and there's ups and downs in it. You get to the last movement, and the last movement, through most of it, takes you to the bottom of humanity. I mean, it's just that boom, 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 you know. Those long lines, those are tragedies, man. I mean, it's just like your whole body's sinking. And then at the end, bells come back. Wow. Pretty powerful stuff, I think.
Absolutely. So, could you talk about your experiences, and I'm not going to pronounce this name correctly, but the Christine Capote?
Christine Capote.
And there's specifically, there was a dissertation that was talking about an experience with this woman and David at Interlaken, and then it then translated to a powerful influence for the trombone concerto.
Christine was my colleague at the University of Miami. She was a flute player, man, you cannot believe. I mean, this woman could play the flute. And she told me once that one of her greatest moments in her life was playing the flute in Das Lied von der Erde. And how much she loved that. She had this sound. So she's my good friend. And so I asked her if she'd like to do this flute concerto. She looked at it. She said, yeah, I'd like to do this. And so she worked hard. And David came, and she couldn't play a note of it. Couldn't play a note. She's so overwhelmed by David and the music. but she played it great. I mean, it's one of the great, the flute concerto still remains one of my very favorite pieces of his. I really love the piece a lot. And that's a lot of that's because of her. But she was just terrific, and she played it great. And so she made it through that, and at the end of all that, I decided, I was teaching at Interlochen at that time, and I decided that they didn't have a chamber thing at Interlochen. I begged them, bring Maslanka and let's have the kids play. She'll come play the flute. And it's really hard, but I really wanted that for Interlochen. I wanted it for her, I wanted it for him. So they approved it, and so he came and she came. But what she told me between those times was that she had had surgery that removed cancer in most of her body. She was going through that while she was playing that symphony. So she went to Interlochen, and we had a great time, and it was a great experience. And within 2 months, and she wrote me this, I have this letter from her. She wrote to me about her experience and how she felt about it. And she died within 2 months of getting back from Interlochen. David was very close to her. And out of that, one of her best friends was a trombonist. And from that came this piece for Christine, trombone concerto. She was married to a cellist, so from that came a cello and flute concerto, double concerto. So it's all hooked together through her. So that's how that all happened.
Gotcha. So you've been on the committee chair for a couple of dissertations on the life and music of David Maslanka, all of which the people that did these dissertations had pretty extensive interactions with him. Could you talk about some of the experiences working with your students that were working on this project?
I tell you what I can do, and I can set this up for you. That question is better answered by them, and they will do that. They will give you the time that you need and talk to you about their experience. And if I give you that information, I'm speaking for them, and I don't really want to do that. Of course, I'm the one that motivated them. I'm the one, and they knew, because they were, I mean, those guys were with me every day, they knew how I felt about things, and not just David, but just about life itself, and so they were motivated to do these dissertations, and so I can get you their information, and I know these people would love the opportunity to talk to somebody about it, because it's therapeutic, it helps.
So this music is kind of like, it's a hard one to capture through words. It's a hard thing to truly properly talk about without playing the music, especially his music being that it's a deep, universal essence that kind of just emerges throughout you. Do you have thoughts or opinions on extensive scholarship on these kind of writings?
You know what? I read and I write, and I think I told you guys that I'm into photography right now. I've missed not being able to exercise my creative voice in that way. But I have no desire. Somebody else asked me about this. I have no desire to write about David or to do some sort of scholarly work. Now, if somebody should decide that's what they want to do and ask me to be a part of it, I'll be happy to do that. But, and for whatever it's worth, I mean, I read all the time and I try to learn. But at the end of the day, for me, it's about how the brain works through the heart. So I'm a kind of a poetic kind of guy. Right now, especially about that, I don't have a big desire to write about that, although I do have a desire to write and to read. But that's something somebody else can do, not me.
Gotcha. So I have a couple quotes from the interview that I conducted with him that I was just wondering if you could share your thoughts. One specifically, we were talking about Songs for the Coming Day, and he, I'll just describe to you, this was a vision that empowered a lot of his writing post-mass, and he says, and he probably shared with you this vision, he says, some years ago I had a small vision. In fact, it was down the street here, it would be Missoula. I was walking the dogs one night and I passed a house. I saw a window with a light in it. The light just showed a blank window space with a light. And I looked at it at that and had a sudden realization that we are not going to destroy ourselves. It just went, oh, we're not going to do this. Now, where does that come from? I don't know. What reality does it have? I can't prove anything by it. Except that it was the same flash of recognition that comes from a dream or comes from a meditation space. And a voice that essentially is saying in my mind, no, we will not destroy ourselves.
We didn't talk about that specific house, but he talked about that all the time. It's in his music. It's in almost all of his music. At the end of the day, he was optimistic about humanity and human race, but also painfully aware of what we're doing to each other and the earth. And you can hear that and see it in everything he did. So he wanted to be optimistic. And I think he was. But he suffered because of people that would hurt other people, or war, or nuclear, the threat of nuclear, or global warming, or the way people would treat animals, or anything. It's prevalent in our society. And so he was very well aware of it. And it hurt him, but yet underneath that was his heart that just didn't allow that optimism to be completely shut out. I've got something here. I'm not sure that I can find it for you fast enough, but I can find it for you by rehearsal today. There's a book called Visions of Glory, and it's available. You can find it. But in that book is a small two-paragraph interview with David about who he is and what his thoughts were. I'll give that to you. It goes back to his very young childhood and where some of this might have come from. He comes from a very strict religious kind of a background. He was a Jehovah's Witness early. And that's a very strict, disciplined religion. And it talks about him being isolated. And the impact that it had on him. I'll find that. Have you read about it? Do you know about it?
No.
I'll get it for you. I have it here. So I'll try to get it and email it to you. Because that might lend some light into why he struggled so hard to right the ship and stay centered. Did he ever tell you he was an alcoholic?
He only described a certain period of his life as being a very dark period.
Yeah, that was part of it. Then Allison showed up and got him out of that, helped him out. But you know some of the stuff that's in his music that you'll be going along and everything, like the third movement when it starts, it's that beautiful chorale, just disintegrates, man. Within minutes, it's gone. It's like there's just like this bitter, and that's part of who he is, that darkness.
Yeah, especially in his works in the late 80s. Like I was working on the sonata with him, which was an earlier period of his writing. It's very different.
Well, when he was young, he hardly wrote anything that was tonal. I mean, it was just like all over the place. Listen to his very first piano concerto. You know who premiered that? Fred Fennell at Eastman did years ago. The very first piano concerto, but it's a strange piece. Doesn't sound like David at all. But part of that was because, you know, as a composer and as a young person, you're trying to find the latest thing that really says something that nobody else has said. And so you'll do things that are kind of off the beaten track just to prove that you don't have to comply.
Right.
So there was some of that in him. But he was driven by this inner pain that he was in from the time he was very young. And he was lost. No question about it.
Right.
But now, since I've known him, I've been had countless times dinner with him. Never seen him take any alcoholic beverage. Nothing. Wine, beer, nothing. I've seen him drinking O'Doul's, but that's about as far as it goes.
Okay. Here's another quote. We were talking about working with people that were struggling with music in terms of opening up to it. And so he described it as either the person isn't able to open fully.
Yeah. Come on in.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I don't know. Yes, I need that instrument.
Yeah, no problem. Oh, you just need the small one. You don't need the little one, do you?
No. But
here. Okay?
Thank you.
Play loud.
I'll try.
Okay. Sorry about that.
No worries.
Okay.
So the quote was, either the person isn't able to open fully to the experiment of tempo or dynamics or expressive value, or believes that their band or the ensemble, or that they, for whatever reason, cannot go there. So that's the fundamental, is continually asking the people to open fully to what is printed on the page and to open fully to the experiment of how you do that. I realize now that we discussed that to a good length, so we can move on.
We have.
The last one I have is, good artists are those who can allow the deep impulses to come forward in them in whatever way it happens for them. This is composers, this is creative artists in the sense of making something, and it is also performing artists.
Well, you would have to, I could answer that in my words, you can answer it in your words. I mean, you went to Missoula and spent a week with him for a reason. There was something there that you didn't know that you wanted to try to find out. Now, whether or not you found that out, I don't know. You might have found out some, or maybe nothing, or maybe a lot. I don't know. But the thing is, you were searching for something. You still are. And the more you know, the more you feel you have to know. It's never ending. I'm 75 years old, and I still want to know. It's inside of you if you're in it. I've really been working hard on my photography because, for me, I want to say something that I have to say, that I'm not responsible for somebody else. I want to say something about humanity and write about it and put it on in a camera and say something that's important. But I get back here with you guys, we start in it, and that's gone. All I care about is music and the art of music and what it means. And I realize how short I am in coming to understand it. So I struggle harder to know more. And that's what he's talking about. And that's the way he was. He never, ever stopped struggling that I know of. Every time, I'd sit with him. I don't know if I did. I tell you the story about the dominant to the tonic chord.
How it's a miracle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How'd that happen? It wasn't to me, but it should have been. So he was so far ahead of me that I couldn't even walk in his shadow. But that's what he's looking for: is people who are artists, who want to be artists, who want to be fully human. I've got some here I want you to read. I think I write a lot about how I feel. Do you keep a log at all?
A log,
like you journal?
The best I have is just scraps of ideas and random musings.
It helps keep your, you know, where you are and what you're thinking. So I write. I have a little journal with me all the time. But this is something I was still doing photography stuff, and I was thinking about coming here and doing this work with you guys. And so I'm thinking, what am I going to say? And how do I feel about going there? Is it about me? Is it about them? Is it about the music? Is it a combination of all that stuff? How do I feel? So this is something I wrote to myself. I usually write it in a book, but this time I sent an email to myself because it was handy. So that was some of my thinking before I came here. Sounds strange, doesn't it?
Interesting.
So, your observation is that it's more important for you to find moments to express than it was to actually do musical performance?
Because if you don't experience, if you rely on what you know about music and how it's written, it's not enough. Why is it there? And you can only experience it to the depth and the level that you're willing to go there. So the experience, it doesn't mean that it's a universal kind of a thing. If you live your life sheltered and don't try to figure something out or learn something, then you can't experience it in music either. So it's how you live your life. Then the notes have everything to do with it. Can't be the other way around. It wasn't for David either. The notes go down on the page to say what he had to say, or Mahler, or anybody. It has something to say. Stravinsky, anybody.
Right.
Well, I don't mean that to be flippant. Anybody. We're talking about some pretty cool
right.
people here.
Right.
Sometimes it helps me to write down. I mean, you can produce something that's beautiful but meaningless if you're not connected, if you're not deeply, deeply, deeply connected to what you're trying to do. You know what I'm talking about. The older you get, the more you live, the more you'll think about such things. But you're amazing. The stuff you've done is online a kid who was at a college, the Lutheran College in Minnesota, hearing Maslanka's 8th Symphony and how he felt about it. I'll try to find that place so you can read that kid's writing. Timothy Marr is the band director. St. Olaf College is the name of the school. And this kid heard the 8th Symphony. He wrote this. Come in. Wrote this long thing about it. Yeah, no problem. If you can't find it, let me know and I'll find it for you.
Okay.
It's an interesting... The kid goes pretty deep. It's pretty cool. I think you'll enjoy it. I think you'll identify with it. All these things we've talked about, even with David, are things that if you were to have this conversation with somebody that didn't care about it or was interested in something with the same passion you are about something else, the conversation wouldn't have any meaning really. But when you care about something, somebody that is same wavelength, and it begins to take on a deeper meaning. That's what life is about. I mean, it's about everything that we do in our lives. It's great. It's important to think these things, but it's also important to do things other than this. But it's been a long road with me. I've well over 30 years. Since 2 years before the Third Symphony was written. It's a long time, maybe 33 years. He's exactly 6 months younger than I am. He used to give me all kinds of grief about it. I was a lot older than he is.
That's funny.
Yeah. And I guess we both always thought that we'd live forever. So, I really appreciate your work and your thoughts about all this and the depth of which you care about it. I appreciate it.
I just appreciate getting the chance to speak with you.
No problem. If you want to talk to those people, Brent and Lauren, I'll get you their stuff. They can tell you a lot of stuff, how they feel. They're young, so they can tell you how they feel.
Sure.
And what's Lauren was at his memorial when I went up. She was there.
That's powerful.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, the guys who teach within 100 miles, I weren't there. Didn't understand that.
Yeah, I